Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals.
Recently, the NABIP ACA Working Group submitted a detailed 28-page comment letter to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight, outlining our perspectives on the proposed payment notice for plan year 2027. Now, for those of you who don't live this and breathe this every day, and I know there's one or two of you out there, the payment notice, which is often just abbreviated as the NBPP, is essentially the annual rulebook for how the Affordable Care Act markets operate each year. And this year's version touches everything from plan design to risk adjustment, to broker oversight, consumer protections, and the long-term stability of the individual market. So today, we're going to unpack what's in that letter, why it matters, and what it could mean for agents, carriers, and the consumers we serve. And to help us do that, we've invited Josh Brooker, who is chair of the NABIP Individual Markets Working Group, which is part of our generally broad Ledge Council. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you, David.
So let's start a little bit and help acquaint members with what the working group actually does throughout the year. Tell us about your team and what they do.
Yeah, so to unpack that a little bit, NABIP has a board of trustees at the very top, largely comprised of volunteers. They appoint the head of the Ledge Council and a fair number of the members that are the chairs and the members of the working group. So within the Ledge Council, there are currently 14 positions that comprise of the chair, the region representatives from around the country for region 1 through 8, and then different chairs for the individual market, group, Medicare, long-term care, mental health parity, prescription drugs, you name it. We have a cluster of individuals focused on that particular topic that fall under that working group. So as far as the individual market working group, we have 15 members that are volunteers from around the country. They serve out in the world in different capacities, from brokers to FMOs to education-related people, but they're all dealing either directly with consumers in the individual market or supporting the brokers and agents in the industry that support the communities in their area. So definitely an interesting group, but we're focused on year-round advocacy, focused on educating not only Congress and CMS and SSIO, like you had mentioned here, but trying to keep our members abreast of what's actually happening in the market.
So let's talk about the letter itself. How did this comment actually come together? What was that process like?
Yeah, so it's typically when we receive a request from the government, from an agency. Historically, I should say, we have about 60 days to review whatever comes out, to come up with a game plan to respond to that letter. This year, and every year, like you said, the NBPP comes out. This year, not only were we given 30 days to do everything that we needed to, but normally we get this letter in November and it's finalized by Easter. Like, that's always been our Easter break, is reading what is finalized. This year, it was introduced in February as a proposal. We have 30 days to review it. And ultimately, within the letter, the very first page, we say, please, please, please hurry up and give us a final rule, because we don't know where we're going to be. So the rule itself was 577 pages. We do not use AI to summarize it, because unfortunately, within the rule itself, there's a lot of nuance that we want to make sure we're getting everything from there. We create a structured outline of what we're seeing. That's usually a page or two that just gives the bullet points of what's changing. We unpack that. This year, when we did that, it was a 23-page document that gave a summary of each issue and then a background of what legislatively and what regulatorily has changed, what we've dealt with in the past, what our prior comments have been at NABIP, both from the staff, but also from any prior comment letters. We do circle around to other people in the industry just to make sure we have a pretty comfortable number of people that we lean on them, they lean on us to make sure that we're understanding concepts properly. And then we draft that letter. Now, this year, because of the short period, a lot of the initial draft was spearheaded by myself. We got up to 43 pages with the prior comments that we've had from NABIP and then kind of filling in the gaps. But as soon as that was done, my team, which again, there are 14 members this year, specifically in the individual market working group, went through not only for grammar, but also to kind of kick the tires and really figure out how do I feel about different pieces, which we'll dive into those back and forth discussions a little bit later. We finalize what our draft is going to be. So those 43 pages that were written got scaled back to about 23 pages. And then ultimately with the feedback, as we had a call and talked through these concepts at length, wound up being about 28 pages. Wow. We do a final pass, just making sure that our peers are like in the industry aren't seeing something else or haven't heard anything. And then we submit it and try and get it out to our members so that you guys know what's going on, like today.
Sounds like a metric ton of work, especially on that short time frame. So let's dive into that NBPP and bring it down to where brokers are really feeling this, especially around consent and marketing. What did this rule propose around consent and marketing, and where did your comments push back or make significant change?
Well, before we jump into that, I do want to just take a moment of a step back to your comment about being a lot of work. You said it more eloquently than I did. At the start of this, I mentioned we have 14 members of our working group. They're all volunteers, right? So I just want to say thank you to them because it wouldn't happen without them. And I know that they all have their own day jobs and work incredibly hard. So, yes, it is a lot of work, but the people that are members of these working groups at the federal level tend to have a higher calling, if you will, of trying to make the industry better for not only themselves, but for their peers around the country. So I think
Do you want to give a shout out to those folks?
Yeah. So on our end, we have Andrea Bailey, Robert Mulcair, Emily Trevino in Texas, Samantha George in Florida, Dee McFarlane in Ohio, Dustin Van Dwine, Justin Reinig, Rebecca Yates in Utah, Jesse McDonald in Connecticut, Courtney Peterson in Florida, Robert Williams, John Jakowski in Georgia, and David Cook in Texas. So we have quite a bit of representation from people around the country that come from all walks of life, and I really appreciate them. But yeah, I think that leads into the fact that our first conversation here is the broker impact, right? That I think that's key, and a key concern for us is how is our industry going to be impacted? So the MBPP, when it comes to brokers, is looking at three specific things. The first one is I'll do the easiest one first, which is the certification that happens every year. Generally speaking, the majority of people, when they do their certification, go through CMS's portal and they complete it on the website. However, there are 10,000 agents that complete it through a third-party platform. Ultimately, the MBPP is recommending that they get rid of that additional path. And our concern was if brokers are using it right now, and there's really no they cite savings, if you will, but if you're shifting from one path to another, we don't really know how much savings that's going to be. Why are we upsetting process? So we did come back and say, we don't think that that's a prudent use of time. The other two things are the broker consent, which we've been talking about for years, is this idea that we have to have a consent on file, a consent form on file that says we were authorized to interact with the client. And we push back on that specifically because the way that the system has operated for years has been kind of under-regulated, and ultimately CMS came out and said, we need these consent forms so that we can regulate it, but it really hasn't moved the needle. The form itself hasn't moved the needle so much as closing a lot of the back doors, which between the three-way call rule, between having a social security number now being required on applications to be able to submit them, by removing some of the special enrollment periods and by adding verification requirements, all of those integrity metrics are the reason we're not hearing as much switching or issues this year as we have in the past. It hasn't been the consent forms that have been meaningful or caused meaningful change. So we recommended that they get rid of that and strengthen their internal integrity. We did say if they are going to keep it, what they're doing is basically saying that everyone needs to use the standard form. We said if worst case scenario, they are going to keep it, that we would agree that standardized form means that there's not going to be issues from one broker to the next. And ultimately, we want to make sure that everyone's protected if they are acting in good faith. We did highlight a concern about how that's going to work with e-signatures. Basically, if you have to have the same form, there are standard legal practices that if I use a platform like DocuSign or Adobe, signature, a wet actual signature can be used as a legal standard. It can be replaced with an IP address and a lot of the metadata. So we were kind of trying to clarify that, trying to clarify if someone is calling, we don't want, 15 minutes or 10 minutes of a call to be reading a form verbatim. So we wanted to clarify that and just protect the time, because the sad part about open enrollment, especially for individual brokers, is one additional click on an application is going to be multiplied by the number of clients that you serve. So every single thing that is imposed that adds multiple steps or elongated processes means fewer people are able to be supported. So we really wanted to be diligent there. The other piece that they are talking about is setting up marketing standards. We went back and forth as a team on this. Basically, they want to have a preset framework of everything that could be perceived as misleading marketing practices. And they specifically cite Medicare Advantage. Now, in theory, making both industries similar has validity to it and continuity. So that way, if brokers are helping people, they know what they have to do. However, the challenge is that they already have the authority and again, are not using it. They even spell out in the MBPP that they have the authority to hold people accountable for marketing practices. State departments of insurance have authority. The FCC, the FTC have authority, and they haven't done anything with it. So by introducing new marketing oversight and adding more work, again, adds work to good actors, but doesn't deter bad actors. And that's the issue that we're trying to deal with.
So there have been a number of changes, but also some revisions and some new things in this rule. Which parts of this year's NBPP are reversions or revisions versus routine updates, and why are they significant?
Yeah, so this happens with every administration where they tend to roll back what the prior administration did. In addition to that, whenever there are laws that change throughout the year, like the One Big Beautiful Bill that happened last year, they have to bring regulation in alignment with the law. So this year, as far as going back to old standards, when the Affordable Care Act was originally created, it said that there are the 10 essential health benefits and the requirement that they be covered for a qualified health plan. Ultimately, if a state at that point, as of December 31st, 2011, had any additional benefits that they required, like 3D mammograms, autism care, fertility treatment, whatever have you, they're essentially going to be grandfathered in as benefits. But the concern is, if a state has the authority to add whatever they want as an essential health benefit, how does that impact federal tax dollars? So they had a process in place that basically states that states must take ownership of any additional mandates. That was kind of changed in 2019 and also during the President Biden's administration, between states using other states' kind of benchmark to be able to add those benefits, and then also including those benefits without having the states incur the costs themselves. They've added adult dental benefits. So the President Trump's administration is just saying, no, that's not the spirit of the law. We are pulling that back. They're also requiring that insurance companies have to provide documentation about the money that they're pulling in from silver loading, which when in 2017, when President Trump said he was not going to cover the cost-sharing reductions of plans, the states and the plans then started increasing their silver rates. They want data around what that money is actually going to, and to quantify that it's actually going to make up the delta of the funding that they lost. So that's kind of a pullback. The 1 year failure to reconcile during COVID, when people were having income go up and down, and the IRS was backlogged quite a bit. They moved from allowing people to get tax credits if they didn't see an IRS return 1 year prior to 2 years prior. Now they're going back to 1 year, and the 150 SEP, which allowed people of low income to get into the exchange year round, that is also being clawed back in the proposal. As far as those first couple are all financially driven, I would say. They're all going to pull money out of the system, whether it's waste, you know, fraud, waste, and abuse, whether it is the costs that states are passing on to the federal government. They're designed to be financially savings. From an innovation perspective, we have standardized plans that have been introduced, then pulled away, then introduced, and then now they're being pulled away, that basically say that an insurance company has to have a preset plan type for every metal level. That's going to be going away. And for that one specifically, we'll dive into quite a bit in a moment where our thoughts were for that. Everything above this we've supported, but the standardized plans are something that we've had a lot of internal dialogue about that I want to kind of clarify. Quality improvement plans are allowed under medical loss ratios to do quality improvement initiatives. Specifically in the individual market, they're required to do 2 of 5 preset initiatives. During the Biden administration, they stated that plans had to do one, every plan had to do one initiative. the exact same, and then they could choose what their elective, if you will, initiative was. They're backing down to say, no, plan should be able to do whatever two they want of the five. We clarified that we agree with that. And we also clarified, wait, we allow these quality initiatives. We allow federal funding. We need a central way to actually see what the initiatives are, how they've saved the government money. And if there is a way to kind of share that data across different carriers so that there are benefits. We haven't had a mechanism to see into what those initiatives actually come out with. State exchanges traditionally have, so the next one is state exchanges. They've traditionally had the ability to move from being on healthcare.gov to starting their own exchange by submitting a waiver request and a blueprint that says how they're going to do it. A few years ago, there was a requirement that they couldn't go directly from the federal market into a full state exchange. They had to kind of take an additional year on healthcare.gov where they did the backend work. And they're reverting that, which we're fine with. Ultimately, states usually use that step-in process, but even if they don't, there's not been any data to show that that's an issue. During the Biden administration, they also wanted effectively to have progress reports available for their progress with those blueprints. And this is pulling that back. We were not okay with them pulling back the progress reports if they're also going to get rid of a potential year of easing into a system. So we wanted to protect that. Network adequacy oversight has bounced around who's actually the person holding the oversight and compliance, has bounced around between states and the federal government since the enactment of the ACA. They're essentially allowing states to take ownership back from the federal government, which we were fine with. We've seen a lot of states that have had processes in place to validate and audit networks within their footprint that we think are important. Some of the changes that we were a bit more apprehensive about, one was from an income perspective, one of the other back doors that we've seen or ways that people have gotten tax credits that we've been concerned about is individuals that have no income that ultimately report that their income is high enough to get access to tax credits, especially when they're in a non-Medicaid expansion state. So those states that don't have a process for an adult under 133% to get access to Medicaid, they're in a position once their income goes below 100% that they're ineligible for tax credits and they have to pay 100% of an ACA premium. So they're either uninsured, which becomes a liability to health systems, or they overestimate their income. And historically, CMS has said, if we pull your tax return and you overestimate your income, like if you put $50,000 as your income and your tax return said $30,000, they're not going to question that because they know in a situation like that that you're going, if your income is $30,000 but you put $50,000, then throughout the year you're not going to get as much tax credits and ultimately you'll get, you know, it'll get reconciled later, but you're not going to be in hot water. Whereas if your income is zero and you overestimate it to $16,000, well, now you're getting tax credits you weren't supposed to get to begin with, and therefore we should protect that individual. So we do agree that if someone is misrepresenting their income, that there shouldn't be a backdoor into that. One of the concerns that we brought up about income, they are proposing to get rid of the income attestation requirement, and we were very much against that. That requirement or that allowance is that if you can't provide adequate documentation, you can sign an attestation form that says my income is not reportable. That happens anytime I have someone who just retired from work and their prior tax return shows their W-2 from their old job. And by law, if I'm showing proof of income, I have to show proof of what my income is today. If I haven't turned on my pension yet, or my Social Security check, or my IRA, how can I show proof that I have income that I don't? In addition to that, when we're representing income for self-employed individuals, where last year they got a contract from a company that gave them a windfall of cash, and that contract is not being renewed, well, their income changed. And I need to be able to put that their income is lower. So that attestation is pretty important. We'll talk about one of our ideas in a bit, but we're not keen to that idea of removing the ability for someone who does have a lower income to get access to a tax credit. And then the last part that we were very much against as well was the proposal to reduce access, reduce the requirement that plans cover 35% of essential community providers. Right now it's 35%. And the proposal is to move that down to 20%. I think we can all agree across the country, we have network adequacy issues. So the fix to network adequacy issues shouldn't be getting rid of network adequacy requirements. It should be addressing the actual underlying problem. So we weren't really okay with that either. Now, the routine stuff that we see every year, they are asking about the platform fees for states that use the state-based exchange, but the version that has healthcare.gov or the federal platform, that number has been, those numbers have been pretty steady. So, you know, we support and are thankful from a stability perspective that they're not making a lot of changes there. From a risk adjustment perspective, and again, we'll dive into that a little bit more in a bit. They are keeping the same risk adjustment calculation, if you will. And, you know, again, from a stability perspective, we were okay. We did have a caveat, but we'll address that in a little bit. And then from the One Big Beautiful Bill, whenever there is a requirement for a statute, whenever there's a requirement to change the regulation because of a law that Congress passed, unfortunately, we can't do anything about it, right? The idea of government agencies is to interpret what Congress does, not to go against what Congress does. And our comments are neutral. They're basically saying we recognize it. For the migrant population where they're proposing changes, we said we recognize that you're required to make changes under the alignment with the One Big Beautiful Bill. We are concerned about coverage gaps again for that population, and we did voice that concern, but ultimately, like, there's nothing that can be done really there. And then the last one, there's a requirement that any agency that uses federal funds has to have a program to audit whether or not there's waste in the market. And one of the proposals within the MBPP is around states having a process to report what tax credits they're receiving and the population that is impacted. So the concern that we had in the bill itself was they wanted household level data for every application that state dealt with, and we felt that was a bit of an overreach from a federal perspective. Aggregate data, sure, but having identifiable information about households just to verify fraud, waste, and abuse for every state seem like an overreach when you can get an idea of whether or not those individuals are receiving the proper tax credits with their demographic information.
Well, there sure is an awful lot in this.
And that's the easy stuff.
Yeah, well, let's move into the more challenging stuff. what's really new in this NBPP? Like, what hasn't the market dealt with before? And where does your group feel that the most uncertainty lies?
Yeah. So when I said earlier, we kind of circle around to other industry peers when we're in the early phases of auditing things. I had a lovely peer from an EDE, an enhanced direct enrollment platform, when she looked at my notes and saw I literally wrote math ain't mathin', because that's practically what was written in the notice of benefit and payment parameters, is the Affordable Care Act math just doesn't work anymore. So the first thing that they are looking at is, when it comes to the plans, the bronze, silver, gold, and platinum, these plans are required to fit within an actuarial value, right? 60% of claims for a bronze, 70% for silver, 80% for gold, 90% for a platinum. And what happened within CMS and SSIO's analysis is, with out-of-pocket maximums being limited, like, they are a cap to what a plan can have as to what they pass on to a household, they can't make the actuarial values work the way that they need to. So they're actually suggesting for next year a $12,000 out-of-pocket maximum across the board. However, in those lower tiers within bronze and within catastrophic plans, that they would have the ability to exceed 12,000. And the rationale is, the way the ACA is written, you're not allowed to exceed the maximum out of pocket, right? You're not allowed to exceed whatever this set out of pocket maximum is. You're also not allowed to exceed the actuarial value. So their argument is, well, if we're already breaking this rule over here, then we should be able to offer a plan that meets the maximum out of pocket, but fails the actuarial value. And then another plan that meets the actuarial value, but doesn't follow the rule of the maximum out of pocket. And they're specifically looking at catastrophic and bronze plans, because those plans have a harder time of passing more requirements down to patients. We opposed it. We said there's a lot of other things that we recommend. We also said that this is kind of a band-aid, or could be a runaway issue, because if you're saying that the money isn't going where it needs to go, and part of that is because claims keep going up, and the maximum out of pocket is a limiter, well, we need to address claims. Like, what are we talking about? We need to address the underlying costs of healthcare, not say, yeah, let's just have a runaway out-of-pocket maximum for plans to make the math work. That doesn't work for us. They did reintroduce non-network plans, which effectively, you know, as the name suggests, don't have to have a formal network. They have to have a schedule of what they'll cover, and a minimum, they have to show a minimum threshold of providers in the service area that will accept those payments. We ultimately came back and opposed it, and again, we'll get into that in a bit. But some of it was related to, once you're in the plan, if there's no contract that requires those providers to accept it, there's no certainty, and could become an issue throughout the year. Catastrophic plans, we've seen the administration talk more about catastrophic plans. So on that topic, last year, they basically said, if your income was above 400% of the federal poverty limit, you could argue that that you have a financial hardship and get access to a catastrophic plan. And these catastrophic plans were originally designed for people under 30 years old to just try and help prop up with a healthy population for the pool. They do not allow for tax credits. They do not allow for a lot of first dollar benefits. And up until now, we've heard from a lot of insurance companies that they weren't sustainable because of the revenue, ultimately the margin that they had coming in, which is why only 18 states even have a catastrophic plan today. So they've introduced last year the 400%, allowing more people to sign on to these plans. The proposal now is to allow the catastrophic hardship to extend and include people above 250% of the federal poverty limit and below 100%. We support under 100%, and our conversation, I actually had this conversation with Kaiser Health News, was if you are truly below 100% of the federal poverty limit and you're not an expansion state, you're between a rock and a hard place anyways. So having the authority to enroll and the ability to enroll in a catastrophic plan, if you can afford it, at least gives you some kind of exposure protection, and that's insurance, trading risk for premium. So having that ability for people under 100%, we certainly agree with. We did not agree with people, the other proposal that they allow catastrophic plans for above 250% of the poverty limit. Generally speaking, if someone's eligible for tax credits, we're not recommending that they go off market or they go with a plan that would strip them of those benefits, especially when you consider the fact that those individuals would essentially enroll in a plan where not only are they not getting tax credits, but they're losing a lot of those first dollar benefits that they would otherwise have. They, regarding catastrophic plans, they've also introduced the ability for catastrophic plans to span multiple years, up to 10 years even. And we're not sure specifically how that's going to work in the market, if there's going to be a lot of uptake by issuers, but we also don't want to remove choice. So we weren't opposed to that plan design if someone could make it work in an innovative way. The only thing that we were concerned about was part of the proposal said, what if we had deductibles that reset every month, all the way down to every month, right? And we've experienced with short-term medical in some states where it's a three-month plan. We've seen carriers that have kind of layered them together into multiple plans that reset every 3 months. And we know how painful that is for people that have conditions to have to reset every 3 months. I could not even imagine once a month. So we agreed for the innovation and specified that we would like to see those the resets at no less than a year. And then there was a lot of talk about medical loss ratios and whether or not states should have authority to adjust the medical loss ratios. Currently, 80% of premium that comes in has to go out for healthcare costs. And if carriers can't show proof that that's happening, they have to reimburse the consumer. So we did provide a lot of information about medical loss ratios as well, but they're looking at changing it. And that's been a long time. That's been a core tenet of the ACA since inception. So just a novel idea that they're looking into those changes.
So where does our letter go beyond just agreeing or disagreeing, support or oppose?
Yeah. I spoke about the income verification earlier, right? Where if people retire, if they have a fluctuating income, they need that attestation. One of the recommendations we actually put into the MBPP, which I think is really interesting, is whenever you apply for coverage through the individual market, the system has to go to a hub. Automatically, behind the scenes, they ping this federal hub that checks, are they a citizen? What was their income? Who's in the household? Like, there are multiple checks before they determine eligibility. One of our kind of novel recommendations was, well, instead of just asking the IRS, what was the income and who's in the tax household, why not ask, what was the income, who's in the tax household? And what schedules does this person file? not what's on the schedules, but if the IRS hub returns that this person files a self-employed Schedule C, well, maybe we open the attestation just to those people, right? Or they have Schedule E or K-1 or anything like that. It's not going to deal with all the edge cases, but we did recommend that's an automated process that could at least return a little bit of data and help with validation. The standardized plans is probably the next one that I'll talk about because I've seen some conflicting concerns online. So I definitely, these next ones are feedback that we receive from the membership, and I just want to address them. There's been an argument that standardized plans, and again, our team talked about this at length. I had some really good feedback from Rob Mulcair on our team about what happens if standardized plans go away. How is that going to impact training? How is that going to impact consumers that have to now move? So there was a lot of internal dialogue, but the concern that I've seen externally has been this apples to oranges compare of Medicare supplement, where in Medicare supplement, you know what a plan G or a plan F or N or D covers. So having a standardized plan on our end would allow continuity and allow us to know what was covered. The issue with standardized plans when they were originally introduced was they have been called standard, they've been called simple. They've been put on to exchanges, but only about 20% of people actually use a standardized plan. And the standardized plan just says, if you are enrolling in a bronze plan and it's a standard plan, it's going to have all standard plans in the bronze category are going to have X is the same deductible, copays, first three visits are free, annual out-of-pocket maximum, but they're identical in what the features are of the plan. So in theory, that sounds similar to a plan D or a plan N or a plan G on the Medicare side. The concern that we have is that while it dictates the factors, right, the deductible, the coinsurance, the copays, it does not dictate what's in the drug formulary. It does not dictate the network, whether it's an HMO, PPO, POS, EPO, whatever have you. And it looks like simple or standard, but it's in a way that almost for the people that do it themselves can be misleading. They may look at two plans and say, oh, they're the same coverage, but then realize that their doctor is not in network. And for the vast majority of people, Sosayo even said this at our Capital Conference, 75% of people work with an agent or broker. So when you're working with an agent or broker, you're getting pointed recommendations based upon your actual needs. The word standard doesn't change that. And what we saw was when standard options came out, a lot of plans that were trying to do different innovation, different plan designs, were then forced to offer plans in every single one of those categories. And then it got stricter with additional regulation that said you can only have a limited number of plans that weren't in those categories for every one that you had in those categories. So it kind of bloated the system and got us to a point to where today we have less choice. And again, with one in five people having that, if those people were recommended that plan by a broker, it wasn't because it had the word standard in front of it. We just think the idea of innovation makes a lot more sense. The non-network plans, our concern, David Cook in Texas actually brought this up, was there are a lot of areas around the country that have tried to implement reference-based pricing. And there have been a lot of concerns where rural health systems have flat said, we're not going to do that. We don't have enough confidence in those systems or in those plans. And we have nothing in writing that says that we have a relationship. And the insurance companies and the hospital trade groups have actually joined a coalition against these non-network plan designs for that very reason. So it was originally it was more of a concern for rural health that we want to make sure there's access. We saw between the proposal of these non-network plans and the fact that they were saying we're going to scale back the number of essential providers from 35% to 20%, we saw a clear direction that CMS was trying to get to, and we're just concerned about quality and access to care for consumers. From an innovation perspective, it sounds interesting, and we certainly don't want to deter innovation, but we also don't want to proactively support methods that detract from consumer access. We had a conversation with Rebecca Yates, our legislative on our working group, with a concern about how Alaska would be impacted. We also had a conversation with Janet from our Ledge Council, who was concerned because she's coming from California, and there's a lot of submitted proposals to change the benchmark plan in the state. We've seen, since the inception of the Affordable Care Act, we've seen a proliferation of HMO plans that have come into a market, picked one health system, and basically took the lowest slots in the silver medal structure, which are the plans that determine tax credits for that county or that service area. And because they lowball that market, they then have a mass migration to their plans, because in order for the rest of the population to stay in their old plan, they're getting, even if that plan stayed the same price at a gross level, if they're getting less tax credits, they're paying more out of pocket in net premium. So these plans found with HMOs and with these kind of narrow provider network designs that they were able to move in and get a pop of new members by undercutting the market. And we've seen that across, like, spread across the country. We also brought up the fact that if there are non-network plans, that's going to be a similar, we see that being a potential similar migration. One of the suggestions we did make is, in the event they do finalize non-network plans, which we don't agree with, that they don't allow non-network plans specifically in that silver tier, because we don't want the silver plan migration to basically force the market across the country to adopt non-network if that's not the choice they want to make. So, so on the state defrayal side, where they're saying states need to take back paying for these additional mandated benefits, a lot of the benefits that were brought to our attention were pre-2011 anyways. There have been mandates that have come along since then in different states. I think there are 11 states total that have mandates that have been post-2011 that would be required to essentially take ownership or change their laws to not make that a mandated benefit anymore. One of the things that we did spell out at length for SSIO was they're trying to get this to be done for 2027. And again, we're used to having a final rule by April. We're used to having a kind of a clear path in front of us, because states have, or insurance companies have to start submitting their rates in April. This year, I think it's April 16th, if I'm not mistaken. So having all of these changes that are supposed to be reconciled and in the rates for April are going to be very difficult. Having a requirement that states no longer cover, or the federal government no longer cover the cost of certain things, and states having to absorb that, creates instability for these plans that are uncertain about where they're getting the flow to be able to pay for things. And that risk becomes premium, right? It's an adjustment to their premium. So we actually suggested that that doesn't go into place until 2030. Specifically, we were looking at Nevada, because Nevada has a legislative cycle of every 2 years. And the next time they would even be able to look at changing their laws to make appropriations for these costs would be sometime in 2027. They'd have to make a change to their plan during that period. That takes 2 years to happen. So we really push back any changes until that comes along. And then I would say the last kind of big thing that we were looking at was risk adjustment. With the Affordable Care Act, risk adjustment was designed to say, if you have a healthy population, generally speaking, you're better off than your competitor who has a sick population. And we don't want people cherry picking healthy populations. There's no one carrier that's trying to get the healthy market. So with risk adjustment, we did recommend that they look at the cost of this program, because right now, in theory, if you have a sicker market, you're getting a refund. And if you have a healthier market, you're owing money in. That stabilizes the market in theory. But in practice, all of that's due in August when these carriers are trying to figure out which plans are going to offer next year. So we did make recommendations about doing that over any payment into the system being over multiple months to, again, reduce the risk and reduce the overhead of these plans that might have populations that are on either side. So there's not as much of a swing.
So we've got about 5 minutes left. If we sum up, looking at it from practitioners' point of view, from the folks who work in this market, what's the big opportunity and what are the big risks that are coming out of this that you're seeing?
Yeah. So in general, I think the patches that the MBPP make to close kind of the back doors in the system makes sense, right? Making sure that we don't have people that are enrolling in plans that they don't belong in, making sure that if we do have runaway costs, that we're not adding more into those premiums that should fall under states or should fall under the insurance companies. We should have the ability to see in, you know, transparency is a big thing today. We should have the ability to see in to what quality initiatives are being done, to how these plans are structured with their PBMs, with their other vendors, that ultimately this is trying to get to the heart of is where our dollars actually going in the system. I think that's going to be a big help. The broker requirement to have a standardized form, if that's where we're headed, at least a standardized form would mean everyone has the same standard and we don't have to worry about interpretation of the law, which right now has been an issue where people have misinterpreted and you know, paid the price. I do think the concern comes down to these quote unquote enhancements, if you will, of what happens if, you know, maximum out of pockets are 15,000, right? And you have a household that can't afford that. That's a concern. What happens if the plan is a non-network plan and you can't get in to see a doctor? Those are very serious conversations that are going to need to be had. And what happens if they rush these issues without proper education, both for the agent and broker community and for consumers? We could have a position where people are unaware that they enrolled in something. So a lot of our recommendations have been around, you know, take it slow. If you're going to do something novel, make sure that you have the right infrastructure in place to handle educating everyone about it. But I do think the intent here is to remove a lot of the backdoors, continue to remove a lot of the backdoors. And what I will say kind of as a closing is a lot of what is proposed has been proposed before. Some of it has been reversed by lawsuits that ultimately did not find that they were lawful. Right. So keep in mind, if there are certain things that you hear We have, since the inception of the Affordable Care Act, it's been a pendulum of every year something's changing. Don't stress about what isn't concrete, and everything is either an opportunity or an obstacle. And you know, David, as well as I do, being in this industry for as long as we have, that you longer than me, of course, but as long as you're focused on helping people, you're going to be able to keep doing that.
Well, kudos to you and the entire Individual Markets Working Group. If you didn't understand how much time and effort a lot of our volunteer committees put into this stuff and to getting it right, this is an amazing, amazing group. And we're really proud of everybody who's on the committee and what you all accomplished this year. And thanks for getting these answers about how the real world operates and what real world changes will be out to the regulators. Josh Brooker, thanks so much.
The only thing I would add is on Tuesday, there was an email that came out saying that all the committees are accepting applications at this point. We love smart people that are in the room that are there for the right reasons, and we'd love to have you. So definitely appreciate the time. Again, a lot of the conversations that we had around this bill were from people just reaching out and asking questions, and our final document was not the 43 pages we started with. So definitely want to hear from people, and if you want to get involved, we'd love to have you.
Thanks again, Josh.
You can have the Healthcare Happy Hour podcast downloaded automatically by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also find a link to the podcast in the member-exclusive Washington Update published on Fridays. For more information on our government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit nabip.org.